This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
If you ask me who I am American. I mean, because how many generations does it take to be an American, right? We got 5-6 generations, right?
That's the question, isn't it? Legally, the answer is one. One generation should be what it takes to be an American. But it's not so simple. This is the rest of what Alex Sotelo had to say.
And yes, I am very Mexican. I was born in Mexico. I was raised in Mexico. My parents are Mexicans. My grandparents are Mexicans, right? This is actually true reality. We are like whales. We are part of that natural migration. And it's been proven on my family throughout generations. And we call home Napa Valley, as we call home Zacatecas, Mexico. And we feel home either way. Because actually we got roots. Even though we moved someplace else, we can move to Atlanta or Houston or New York or any place else, and it's still going to be home because we are part of that community.
So perhaps we should shift the question around. How long does it take to feel like an American? Hello, this is our fourth and final episode of the Mendatang Kamath, a series aiming to understand immigration and what it takes to come somewhere new and to feel like you belong. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the last three episodes, I've been exploring the United States, using it as our looking glass to examine this complex mess of bureaucracy and politics and feelings. We've covered economics.
And it eventually got down to the issue of emigration from China. So Jimmy Carter said to Deng Xiaoping, you have this policy which you basically prohibit Chinese nationals from leaving the country. How could you possibly hope to join the club of civilized nations if you don't allow your people to go? Deng Xiaoping smiled, sat back for a little bit and thought about it for a few seconds and said, Mr. President, you're absolutely right. So how many Chinese nationals do you want? 10 million? 20 million? 30 million?
We've covered politics.
And I just saw backstage some of the families who were decimated. Their families were decimated. Their sons, their daughters killed by illegal immigrants. And it's a massive problem. We have to stop illegal immigration. We have to do it. We have to do it.
And we've covered history.
Over 12 million men, women, and children passed this way. Passed through rooms and corridors haunted with a special stillness which remains only in places once noisy with human life. Here they bought tickets for 1,000 places in America.
Today, it's personal. Because what's more personal than home?
We were born and raised in the United States, and even though we felt very Chinese, were raised very Chinese, we did not celebrate Christmas. We had, my grandparents were Buddhist, so we always had Buddhist traditions in our home. But our culture was very American. And I knew we looked different, and people, even though our friends were very accepting of us, there was always a difference. There was a separation. So I never really, even though I'm here in the United States, I don't feel like I'm fully American, if that makes sense. I don't feel like this is completely my place, that I'm fully accepted everywhere I go.
That's Patty Chang. You're going to be hearing a lot of Patty in this episode, but mostly because while talking to her, I kept getting deja vu. Maybe it hit a nerve because so much of what she said reflects the experience of being Malaysian and Chinese too. Like what happens when you actually listen to all the people who tell you to go back to where you came from?
The first time I went back to China with my dad, it was, it felt like a foreign country. Other than it was wonderful to see all these people who I look like and who look like me. I love that. And I love being surrounded by our native tongue.
But for all the good that you feel there, it just will not do.
But I still felt like a foreigner, like I didn't belong. And people look at us like we didn't belong. My cousins in Taiwan, when I first went there, they said that I walked differently than the other Taiwanese, the girls in Taipei. And I said, what do you mean I walk differently? And he said, you walk, you're more independent. You walk with this confidence or this independence. And so we can tell that you're a foreigner. And I'm also a little bit bigger. Most of the girls in Taiwan and China are still bird-like. And I've got more of a healthy American, I guess, an athletic build. You kind of feel like you're in no man's land. You're not fully American, and you're not fully Chinese.
Patty's Chinese American family held on to traditions from the motherland fiercely.
My mom would always tell me, especially my mom, you are not American. You are Chinese. You are not Caucasian. You are Chinese. This is your family. This is where you're from. My parents separated and divorced when I was young, so we were raised by my mom. Mostly. But my father and all my aunts and uncles, we would see each other all the time, and they would always tell us stories about Taiwan, their lives in Taiwan and China, and we only ate Chinese food. We didn't celebrate Christmas. Our culture was not American in any way when I was growing up.
But they're not alone in that. Here's Alex Sotelo again and Rafael Rios. Alex speaks first.
But we'll feel very comfortable because they keep that heritage in their everyday living, almost, through the food, through the talking, through the connection, through the phone call to grandparents, through the involvement, through the identity.
Growing up, we used to go back to Mexico. Early on, it was twice a year during the holidays. We did that all the way through till I was in high school. Everything at home, we only spoke Spanish at home. Even once we all knew how to speak English, it was all Spanish, you know, the traditional cooking. So they just kind of continued their normal, you know, customs and everything that they grew up with, as to the extent that you can here, you know, without all the big celebrations that go on. But we saw some of that when we would return to Mexico on vacation.
You might have noticed that I've spent most of the series describing people as Mexican-American or Chinese-American. It's not just to tip you off to their heritage in case the surnames weren't giveaways. Instead, it's because identity that's forged in a melting pot is uneven and colorful and evolving.
This is the home that I know. I've learned to realize that I am different. I am Chinese-American. I'm American-Chinese. I go back and forth between the two. I don't say one over the other because it's not a political thing for me. It is who I am. I'm an American-born Chinese girl. And I've just finally come to realize that it doesn't matter if others don't accept me as American, or back in Taiwan or China, that they don't accept me as being Chinese, because I know who I am.
With the whole American as an immigrant nation narrative front and center, what does this mean going forward, both for the people already there, as well as the people even now planning to arrive? Paul McDaniel of the American Immigration Council has some interesting ideas.
The geography of immigrant settlement in the U.S. has become much more diverse in the last few decades. You see higher growth rates of immigrants moving to new destinations. Cities in the southeast U.S., for example, or in the Midwest, places that don't have long histories of receiving immigrants are now suddenly in the last decade or two receiving a high growth rate of immigrant populations. And in some cases, they're settling in particular neighborhoods.
And in our last episode, Sybil Fox talked about how immigrants tend to end up living in inner cities just because of economics. Well, the map of immigration is actually changing.
It's usually not the case that they're settling in the inner city. It's usually that this new immigrant settlement is much more suburban. And so you see a lot of times in these new immigrant destinations, you'll see more dispersal of immigrant settlements and not necessarily one specific neighborhood. I think in the places that you do, it's part of, like, it goes back to thinking about migration networks. So one person moves to one place, they tell other people about that place, and they attract more people from similar places to move to that particular location.
And while we might struggle with a one-size-fits-all answer for the future of immigration or the success of the folks who choose to move, Paul has encouragement.
The very act of immigrating, to choose to move to another country, I think that's an entrepreneurial act in and of itself. But also, there is one thing that sometimes some immigrants might not have access to certain types of jobs, and so they choose to start businesses as an alternative.
Clara from the Human Rights Watch thinks that there are ways to match up expectation to reality.
There are lots of countries in the world, and you know, Malaysia included, that have experience with immigration. people move around the world. It seems to be a universal truth. People move to Brazil and to Europe and to, you know, and to Malaysia, and then people move for lots of reasons. And, you know, I think that there is a self-conception in some parts of the American political concept of a nation of immigrants, and that's probably correct. You know, that is, I think, correct as a historical matter. So the U.S. is well-placed to be, and should be well-placed to be, a leader on human rights compliant immigration policy. And that's what we'd like to see. Current policy doesn't reach that level, despite this sort of self-conception as a nation of immigrants and the idea that one can come here and be part of the American dream. And to be honest, the high levels of immigrant history in nearly every American's background. What we'd like to see is for U.S. immigration policy to match up, basically, with that self-conception.
Trying to fit culture and upbringing into the expectations of an entire nation is no small thing, and it's not easy. So, what are we to do? Up next on The Pendatang Kamath, some suggestions. You're listening to BFM 89.9.
It's all out of respect. If you respect the people and the land and the area, then you have no problem. Once you start showing disrespect, that doesn't go. So it's all out of respect that these things, these changes have occurred, because it's from respect and trust. These women were allowed to learn our customs and language because they were trusted, and they have children, and they have grandchildren, so it's a good life. And instead of going to Korea and fighting, they end up marrying the ladies from there. So they kind of, instead of fighting, they went the peaceful way. And actually, to the Americas, they would say, like president stuff, you brought the enemy home. That's what they would say, but no, it's the heart and the respect that the people give, and then they shall receive it.
That was Uncle Dave Washington telling me how it came to be that two Korean women found themselves very, very far away on a hilltop mesa, being the wives of Hopi men and part of the tribe. Good afternoon. You are listening to our final episode of The Pendatang Kamath. I'm Lee Chui Lin. It's an exploration of immigration with the United States as our map, although the issues, you'll see for yourself, I think they really apply across the board. So cheesy as it sounds, and I know it sounds cheesy, a big part of why many people move around the world is for love. Yes, sure, money is important as well, but it's often to be able to send money home to their kids and families. And then those kids and families move to be nearer to their own blood. They move, and then perhaps they come to love their new land too. And that's another part of it. Kim Tolbert discusses how it would be to join a different type of sovereign nation, to enroll as a Native American.
Enrollment is not quite citizenship, although we speak about it in that way. We do not naturalize citizens. Pre-World War II, before masses of tribal people left reservations for cities, many tribes did enroll spouses or adopted children, whether they were Native American or not. They stopped doing that post-World War II because so many people were leaving the reservation, and you couldn't just enroll family members anymore. Too many people were leaving and coming back many years later, and they wanted a more foolproof way to make sure that the people that they were enrolling actually were somehow related to them. And so that's when the blood quantum requirements really kind of kicked into high gear.
So that was a more informal arrangement, but it's changed since.
But yes, many scholars will argue, if we're really going to act like nations with citizenry, we need to enroll spouses and adopted children. We need to get away from this sort of biologically essentialist blood quantum talk. You know, that's a great idea. That's a lot easier said than done. Some scholars have also recommended having cultural requirements, language requirements. But, you know, it's hard enough managing documentation with blood quantum statements on it or lineal descent statements. Who's going to be the police of who's adhering to traditional culture in order to get enrolled in a tribe? There is no easy answer for tribal governments. Although, yes, in the past we have had a process of naturalizing people, but that was a very different political economy than the one that we're living in now. So tribes are kind of in a bind.
It's imperfect, but there's something in the native mindset that I think might be helpful for the rest of us.
It was one of those things no one ever doubted. The first people on this continent were the Indians, period. No reason to believe otherwise. But two summers ago in the town of Kennewick, Washington, a skeleton turned up that could turn out to be the missing link between what we thought to be the truth and what actually is the truth. A truth, if it is the truth, that the Indians are not happy with and would just as soon leave well enough alone. The story of Kennewick Man started out like an ordinary murder mystery.
Native Americans and scientists have a relationship that, well, let's just say it wouldn't be unfair to describe it as difficult, fractious. A major part of that has been cases such as the fight over the Kennewick Man, with scientists claiming the right to study him and Native Americans claiming the right to bury one they were sure was an ancestor. This was a belief in which they were vindicated in June of this year.
They came into a community and convinced my tribal council leadership that they will find solutions to diabetes. But they went and used our samples for other studies such as schizophrenia, inbreeding, and the Bering Straits theory, and numerous publications were written using many of these samples of my people.
There was also the historical misuse of the DNA of the Havasupai tribe. They thought their DNA was being studied by scientists to understand why diabetes ravaged their population. Instead, it was used to try and find out more about the tribe's geographical origins, even though they contradicted tribal beliefs.
Unfortunately, in 2006, I was a student at Arizona State University, and we found out just by chance, by listening to a dissertation at the biology department, I happened to be in that room, and I found out that they were using samples of my people, my relatives, to study the DNA structure of a goat, the DNA structure of an African American, and the DNA structure of the Havasupai. These individual people here are victims of that particular scientific research.
So Kim tells us where the Native perspective is coming from.
Historically, there has been inadequate consent from our point of view. What it comes down to is, I think, scientists and the discourse of science having a lot of cultural power and cultural authority. And in the West, thinkers tend to think in terms of facts versus beliefs, and that sort of idea has conditioned the way that scientists approach Native Americans. There's historically been a feeling of having a right to data. So in the West, we have the sense of we have a right to know, we have a right to knowledge, and knowledge is for the good of all. But you've got to pay attention within a discourse like that about who has a right to whose knowledge and whose bodies and lands and cultural practices do you have to access in order to get the data that you want. And with scientists having a lot more cultural power in our society than Native people do, there was historically not enough attention paid to the power that they had and the way that seemingly liberal good idea of knowledge being for the good of all was actually turned and used in a really oppressive way towards Native Americans who are relatively powerless in relationship to science.
So that's all just background, which makes this next statement all the more extraordinary.
To be concerned about that, I think, is to come from a very Western worldview in which science and religion are viewed as oppositional, and that's a struggle that's happening in the West. You also have to understand that in indigenous spiritualities, I don't really like that word any better than religion, but a lot of Native people use the word spirituality, they are not generally proselytizing. You know, we're not looking for converts. And what that means is, historically, even before scientists came in and tried to tell us where we come from and who we are, Christians were doing that. So we've been dealing with this kind of intellectual bullying already from the church. So we've developed some pretty good skills for dealing with it from science.
And here's the kicker.
And one of the things I'm really proud of a lot of Native people for doing is being able to hold, in one hand, a spiritual notion of the world. And in the other hand, I interview and I work with Native American bioscientists. They can hold, in the other hand, an evolutionary worldview. And their indigenous background has told them that they don't necessarily need to reconcile these things, that we don't know everything. I feel like our spiritualities teach us to be humble about what we know and don't know and to sort of be open and wait and see what happens.
Which was a bit of an epiphany as far as I was concerned, because I've spent so much time thinking about identity, how it's forged by immigration, what it all means, blah, blah, blah. But the thing is, you can be more than one thing, and you can hold more than one idea in your head at a time. And when you stop thinking about it, you realize that being part of a country is more an action than it is some sort of intellectual or emotional exercise. Tisha Gomez, who went through a long legalization process, knows this better than most. I'll let her tell her story.
The biggest motivation for me was that I wanted to go back home and visit my family and not have the hustle that I had coming in. It was not easy coming in. I came through Florida, and it was an interrogation that I felt like I was a criminal, the way they interrogated me, but they let me pass. And I just stay over my visa. But dealing with immigration was not something I was there. All immigrants are very afraid of the immigration officers and all the bad stories we hear. So we always try to stay away. There was an opportunity to become, to apply for a green card, not become citizen, but to apply for a green card. To a number of people who came to the U.S. through a certain period of time and did a certain kind of labor, and I kind of fit in on that group, with that group of people. So I started my paperwork that way, and it was a very long process. But I got permission to visit Brazil during the time that I was waiting for the green card, which was the best thing that happened, because then I could come and go and see my parents.
In that time, her feelings and impressions of what is now her homeland have changed.
When you come in Brazil, you always look to America as the place to be, and people are so friendly and nice and this and that. And then it's a big shock. And I got that first impression right away when I landed and was interrogated if I were a criminal. I mean, they literally searched my suitcase and inside my shoes, and it was just like, it was very strange and bizarre experience to have when you first arrive in a country.
I, for one, don't think that complaining makes her less American. I'd argue that complaining about one's country is a citizen's privilege, especially when things like this happen.
Coming and going, traveling back and forth, I was always stopped at the airport. Always. There was nothing, it doesn't matter what I, you know, the size of the luggage I was carrying or anything like that, I was always stopped. And it was like that for a long time. Eventually, you know, it kind of, it was not as much until, I would say about, you know, a few years ago when I got my American passport. I always was looked differently. And although Americans like to say that, you know, there's not a lot of discrimination and, you know, the immigration officers are there and they don't see any difference and things like that. And that's a myth.
So let's come full circle back to the American dream. Freedom. A house to call your own. Work hard, you can have anything you want. What happens once you get it all?
I think I'm not leaving the American dream. I'm leaving my dream. I have a family. I have a home. I can help my parents. If that is the American dream, I would say then it's just a coincidence. I think the American dream is, I'm trying to look for the right word. It's not a myth. It exists and it happens, but it doesn't happen for everyone. I don't believe I am one of these cases. But I think the American dream, if you want to have a house and have a family and have a car, and this, it's like very materialistic in a lot of ways. And I do not think like that. So for me, having a family and a home, it's more important. So that was my dream.
The first peoples migrated into the Americas more than 20,000 years ago. We were there for 2 weeks. This is by no means a comprehensive study, nor was it meant to be. But I hope I'm not stating the obvious here by saying that one reason America interested me so much, and the reason why the show has taken the shape it has, is not just because of the ferocity of the politics surrounding immigration, but because in many ways it's much of Malaysia's own stories writ large. I think it would be a beautiful thing to reach a point in time where we don't need to spend all these hours gazing into our own navels and pondering our national identity and where we all came from, but instead just live here and now and be. To be secure enough in our own nationhood to do that. Anyway, that's this third generation Malaysian's dearest wish. But this has been The Pendatang Kamuth. Thank you so much for listening. This series was co-produced with Chuan Tech and made possible and as a cooperative with the American Embassy here in Malaysia and the US State Department. Our thanks to them and also to Maria Roach for all her assistance. I'm Lee Chui Lin and you've been listening to BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.